The legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. The lake, it is said, never gives up her dead when the skies of November turn gloomy.
Oh, Gordon Lightfoot with a great song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. And that's what we're going to be talking about on the show today, remembering a historic shipwreck that took place in 1975. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Steve Ackerman is our historian guest today. Steve is Vice Chancellor for Research and Graduate Education at UW-Madison. He's also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And he'll be sticking around at 11:45. We'll have John Martin joining in to talk about weather. But first, we'll take your questions and thoughts about shipwrecks and the Edmund Fitzgerald, and I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Steve Ackerman, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Hey, Larry. It's good to be back on, and thanks for playing that. I am sure now that 90% of your listeners will be humming that at some point during the day.
Yeah, that was a wonderful song in so many ways. And I think it was probably his second most popular song other than Sundown. It's a pretty good description of what happened. But I want to know, how did you get interested in this shipwreck?
So my interest began when it went down in 1975. I was an undergraduate in upstate New York at Oneonta there. And I was a physics major, but in the process of dual majoring in physics and weather, because weather is very much applied physics. And so that first caught my attention, but it wasn't until I moved here that it really grabbed my attention in terms of the storm itself, the song, the ship. And then when I started teaching, particularly teaching about these particular types of winter storms, the mid-latitude cyclone, I was teaching a lecture class, an introductory to weather and climate class with my colleague, former PhD student and now a faculty down in Georgia. And we decided to try and make the explanation about these mid-latitude cyclones that we would talk about a rather historic event. And that meant talking about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. While there was a lot of, you know, discussion about what caused it, John and I both would say it was the weather. It was this storm. And then, you know, talking about the weather and the storm and the song all together just, you know, continued my interest in these types of storms. And clearly there's still a lot of interest disaster, which is probably the second most popular shipwreck next to the Titanic. So how I got into it.
Well, tell us about the ship itself.
So the ship, you know, as the song says, is the, you know, was the American Pride. It was the ship of the American Pride. It was launched in 1958. It was the biggest ship for many years on the Great Lakes. It was like almost 730 feet long. It could travel 16 miles per hour. It weighed almost 14,000 tons. It was, you know, nicknamed the Pride of the American Flag because it was so large. It broke many shipping records. It was launched in 58, and when it was launched, there was on the order of 15,000 people who went there to watch it launch on June 7th, 1958. So An amazing ship. An amazing ship. And as I said, it broke a lot of records in 1964. You know, it became the first ship on the Great Lakes to carry more than a million tons of ore through the Sioux Locks. So,
absolutely amazing. At the time of the wreck, and now what made this, well, what made this shipwreck so unique, do you think?
You know, I think it was a combination of a couple of things. One, it was, you know, the biggest ship to go down in the Great Lakes. It happened so quickly that we really don't know how it sunk. You know, it became a mystery in that we had to take different pieces of information and try and put it together to get an understanding of how it went down, because it went down so fast in a matter of minutes. It went from being on, you know, the seashore to being gone. And then, of course, I think Gordon Lightfoot's song, which came out a year afterwards, really helped popularize the ship and its sinking.
He was quite a sailor himself, or is, was, Lightfoot.
I did not know that part of him. Yeah.
I guess he was quite interested in ships and sailing, and the Newsweek article on the Fitzgerald kind of sparked his interest in writing a song about it. So pretty interesting. Jeff in Superior's got something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Good morning. This is a great story. I was 15 years old, a paper boy for the Superior Evening Telegram. So I picked up my papers on 58th Street and Tower Avenue in Superior and on my bike. And the news wasn't until 6 or 10 p.m. So people were coming up to me wanting to buy papers, and I had to deliver, and people were coming up out of their houses to get the paper because everyone wanted to read the story, the front page story in the Telegram about the Fitzgerald. But I had a question because it's not clear to me even today. Did the ship load at the Superior Iron Ore Docks or the Duluth Iron Ore Docks? Because I know it went out the ship canal and sank, you know, in Lake Superior. But was it loaded in Superior or Duluth?
I believe it was loaded in Duluth. But I'm pretty sure it was. But I suspect if somebody knows for absolutely sure, they'll probably be calling in to either correct or confirm that.
I think that's what, yeah, that's what I remember too. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. You know, how common is something like a shipwreck?
Oh boy, you know, back prior to the sinking of this ship, there was no other big ships that went down in the Great Lakes for like 11 years. But certainly in the 1800s, you know, particularly this time of year, you know, and by this time of year, I mean autumn, we can get a lot of really good, intense storms that can cause real hectic on the Great Lakes, particularly Lake Superior, but also Lake Michigan. Well, all the lakes, actually. And then, you know, it's also, I think, the other part of it, particularly in the 1800s, was, you know, it was getting towards the end of the shipping season, right? So people were also probably trying to get out one more shipment before, you know, winter really set in and they couldn't do anymore. And I think that contributed to a lot of sinking as well in the 1800s.
Yeah. Bonnie in Madison, your turn. Hi, Bonnie.
Hi, it's Connie, and I want to relate a short story that occurred to me. In 1995, in August, I took a trip with my children for the summer vacation to Isle Royale, and at the end of that period, we had a choice of either going down into Michigan or around Lake Superior, and I was in the co-op at, I don't remember where, and just asked a gentleman there, what would you do? And he said, oh, there's not even a small argument. I would definitely take the chance to go around the lake. So that's what we did, literally on the spur of the moment. We started going east along the northern coast of the Upper Peninsula and visited the Shipwreck Museum. This was in 1995. just a month after the Bell had been recovered from the Edmund Fitzgerald. And it was an amazing and very eerie sight, having been a Gordon Lightfoot fan for, you know, most of his career. We proceeded along in that shipwreck museum the next day, I think, or maybe even later that same day. We proceeded up through the Sulaks, and what did we see as the ship in the Sulaks at that moment, the Arthur Andersen? It was the most amazing, coincidental, but chilling moment. And the hugeness even of the Arthur Andersen, the enormity, the narrowness of the locks, the closeness to the edges of the lock that ship came, and the just sheer size of it. It was quite a moment.
Oh, yeah. The Arthur Andersen. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I was there. And of course, the Fitzgerald was bigger than the Andersen, so that would have been that more impressive. For those who may not know, the Andersen left the Duluth Superior area at the same time, around the same time, same day, as the Edmund Fitzgerald, and they traveled together through that fateful day, staying in contact with each other until the Fitzgerald went down. But yeah, that must have been quite a sight.
Bonnie, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate that call. Russ in Stoughton, I believe it's your turn. Hi, Russ.
Hello. I recently read a very introspective article about the diving teams that went down and discovered and observed the Edmund Fitzgerald. And one of them, I would suppose, would have been the ones that brought up the Bell. But in their opinion, they looked at the ship from, of course, only from the outside, and saw that it was broken. But one of their observations was is that many of the hatches on the deck forward of the control tower were popped open. And their opinion was that on one of the when the bow had taken its last dive, it couldn't recover because these hatches had popped open, filled with water along with the weight of the iron ore, and so it could not recover.
What do you think?
There's been debate about one thing we do know for sure, I think, based on the observations and conversations, is that water was getting into the Fitzgerald at some point. And if you think of the talconite ore pellets, which are like iron marbles, if you will, when they're stored in the cargo bay, there's a lot of space in there. And so as the water was coming in, it was filling that airspace in the pellets. And so as the boat was getting lower and lower, even though the Fitzgerald had their pumps running, they couldn't get that water out, and so that made the boat heavier. How the water was getting in is where a lot of anticipation and theorizing occurs. I think, you know, when you look at some of the conditions of the boat with some of the hatches, because the Fitzgerald was pretty much ripped in half, I think it's going to be hard to separate out the stress on the boat as it ripped it in half on what the hatchways were doing, because some of the hatchways still were on the deck, were still, you know, closed up on the deck.
Yeah, I think, so
I think there's a lot of still controversy about, well, not controversy, there's a lot of theorizing about how the water was getting in.
Yeah, and I think the final official report that came out exonerated the people that were in charge of the hatches.
So when the first investigation went in, that's where they thought the water was coming in, that the hatches weren't tightened down. And then since then, there's been no real strong evidence for that their water could have been coming in other ways as well. And that actually led Gordon Lightfoot to change the words in his song later on. So his song overall is generally pretty accurate. There's a couple of things there and here and there that are wrong. But you might remember, depending on how old you are, what is that phrase where he says that the fellas, it's been good to know you. How does that go?
Yeah.
Does anyone
know? The cook. Yeah. The cook said.
Yeah, right. And so I'm trying to find it now. I have that. I just had that up here, but I don't have the new words. Oh, at 7 p.m., a main hatchway caved in. He said, fellas, it's been good to know you. And so that was, again, remember, he wrote this in 76, and that's what one of the Safety Transportation Board analysis said, was that water was getting in through the hatchway. After that, in 2010, he changed that to at 7 p.m., it grew dark. It was then he said, fellas, it's been good to know you. So yeah. He took out that phrase about the hatchway because people then began to theorize that, oh, well, the sailors didn't, you know, secure that well enough. And out of respect for the families and lack of evidence, he switched those words. Although there's still an issue with that phrase, I think, and that is, you know, when the cook says, fellas, it's been good to know you, implies that they knew they were going down. And I think, you know, the rapidness of how they went down, I think, and the communications between the Fitzgerald and the Anderson captains clearly suggested they did not know that they were going to sink in a few minutes.
One other change that Lightfoot made, I remember his original song had the church, was a musty old church, and somebody complained about it, the fact that it was not musty, and so he now sings it, he changed it to from musty old hall to a rustic old hall.
Right.
That was one other change he made. Well, we're having some fun today talking with Steve Ackerman, Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, about the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Questions, join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Certainly love to. We heard some good experiences so far. You may have one that relates to it, too. 1-800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller, Natalie Guyette, our producer, Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network.
The ship was the pride of the American side, coming back from some mill in Wisconsin. As the big freighters go, it was bigger than most, with a crew and good captain well seasoned, concluding some terms.
The Edmund Fitzgerald, Gordon Lightfoot singing about it, and we're talking about it here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Steve Ackerman, who has given many talks on the sinking of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Of course, he's Vice Chancellor for Research and Grad Education at UW-Madison, also a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Let's go to Fred in Madison next. Fred, thanks for waiting.
Yes. Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yep.
Great. Well, this is a fascinating discussion, and I was going to talk about the hatches, but the issue's already been brought up. But the factor of hatches relates to another line in the song. Near the end of the song, Gordon Lightfoot says they'd have made Whitefish Bay if they'd put 15 miles more behind them. And the implication is once they got into that bay with smaller waves, they would have been safe, but not necessarily. They were leaking. They were going lower and lower, and they may have scraped the bottom of the ship on reefs because they were 40, 50 feet lower than they should have been because the waves were pushing them down. There's no guarantee that if they had made Whitefish Bay that they would have made it. And I do tend to believe the hatches argument. I know I'm interrupting you. I think people in the workplace then and now often cut corners. And there is evidence that the habits of people working on the boats in the Great Lakes who were born 1910, 1920, 1930, 1940, people who are now often deceased, they cut corners. And they, if you secure a hatch, it can take 2 seconds or it can take 20 seconds, depending on how many latches and, you know, safety measures you take. So that's my comment.
Fred, thanks.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think you make a really good point there about, you know, even if they had taken a shorter route and got there sooner, would they, you know, been safe? There are two points that I would also agree with you with regard to that comment. One is the locks were shut down. The water was so rough. The lighthouse also lost power there as well. And the other thing is that recently, I think it was about 4 or 5 years ago, there was a numerical weather prediction group that redid the whole forecast to take a look at how it was doing and what the conditions were on the lake. And what they show is that area between where the ship went down and Sault Ste. Marie is where the waves were the worst. Having made it would not have guaranteed that they still would have been safe.
And the waves, how big are we talking here for waves?
Some of the waves from ships that were on the lake, so these weren't the only two ships that were on the lake, but they were talking 20, 25-foot waves. Observations were being made that big. That's a two-story building coming at you. So pretty big.
Yeah.
Pretty big waves.
Mary in Boston, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Well, I'm calling in. I was quite fascinated with the topic this morning, and I have a little bit more of a personal take on things. I grew up in Milwaukee, and I was a senior in high school in 75 and working at a senior retirement place. And my memory is going into work on that weekend, and one of the residents there was related to Edmund Fitzgerald personally. I believe she was his sister-in-law. And she was inconsolable. Newspapers spread all over her suite and on her bed, and she just cried her eyes out all day long. I sat in with her part of the time, and other members of the staff, too, were there just having a really hard time bringing her to terms with things.
Mm.
And I thought, never forgot.
Oh, well, Mary, thanks for sharing. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Does Steve a comment? You probably read about some of those kinds of issues.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the comment I would make is that it's really important to remember that 29 lives were lost when that ship went down. You know, it is very interesting to theorize what happened, how it happened, but it's also really important to remember that a lot of lives, not just the 29 lost lives of the sailors, but the impact that had on those families was, you know, a whole other type of disaster.
Yeah. Thanks again, Mary. Let's go to Dan in Escanaba, Michigan. Hi, Dan.
Hi. I was the general foreman at the Escanaba Ore Dock back in the 80s, and I remember sailors telling me that the Edmund Fitzgerald had been cut and lengthened in order to install an unloader on it. And I didn't know if you had already addressed that or if anyone has ever addressed that, if that contributed to it breaking in half.
Yeah, from what I've looked at, they have, you know, there was talk about extending it and making it longer, but not that any changes in the ship structure would have led directly to the disaster that occurred.
Okay, so it may have been lengthened, but they didn't think it would have had an impact.
But if it was lengthened, I don't think it was lengthened in the middle.
Oh.
And I'm only saying that because I've seen two measurements of the ship, 729/, and then something else. So it wasn't like it was, you know, another 100 feet or anything was added onto it.
Okay.
I'm trying to look that up right now.
All right, Dan, stay listening.
I didn't know if anyone had addressed that. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for calling. Steve will probably be taking a little look at that while we turn to Steve in Sheboygan, Wisconsin. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Well, I just wanted to throw a little anecdote in. I, years ago, knew Edmund Fitzgerald's daughter, Elizabeth. And after Gordon Lightfoot made the song, the publicist wanted to have a picture of Gordon Lightfoot made with Edmund Fitzgerald. And the family did not want that to happen. But Gordon Lightfoot and the photographer snuck onto the family's grounds when Edmund Fitzgerald was sitting out in the backyard and got the photo. And the family, at least the daughter, was not very happy with this. That's my comment.
Oh, that's another interesting.
I had not heard that.
You get these.
It's really interesting to get these stories that go on. One of the things that I had heard is that Gordon Lightfoot had become, and I don't know this because I don't know him, but had become close with some of the families, and that also contributed to him changing that phrase about the hatchways.
Oh, interesting. Steve, thank you. It's fun, isn't it, hearing these stories from everybody who's calling in? They're really enjoying this. You can join in, too. Number to call. Maybe you've got a question or an experience to share. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Carol in Rhinelander, thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Hey, you called me just before I walked into the Y and need to put my mask on. Hi, Steve. It's Carol Rosenberg. Remember me from many things.
Oh, yes. Hi.
Hi. So, anyway, I'm from Milwaukee originally. Saw the ship in dock there many times. And when I was chaperoning the International Science and Engineering Fair in Detroit in 2000, I decided to go to the Maritime Sailors Church and check it out because of the song. And it's definitely rustic. It's not musty. Talked to a docent, and she told me that Edmund himself came every year in the spring for the blessing of the fleet service that they have, and where they memorialize everybody. The church bell chimed. It ran 29 times, And he was very emotionally, it affected the rest of his life. And I don't know exactly when he died, but I don't know if it was his dad or his grandfather, but the Fitzgeralds are of the Northwestern Mutual Insurance Company. That was the company that actually owned the Arthur Andersen as well.
Yeah, and the shipping was in their family as well. So not just the Mutual Liberty Insurance Company, but also some of his family was also, I think grandfather was also a captain of ships.
And that ceremony that takes place, does that still take place every year, Carol? Do you know?
As far as I could tell, it's been 20 years since I was to the church, but at the time they do have the memorial service and the blessing of the ships every year in the beginning of the shipping season.
No.
It's called the Maritime Sailors Church. It's a charming little limestone church that was moved from its original location, and it's right down in the Renaissance Center area along the Detroit River now.
Interesting. Carol, thank you.
Yeah.
I didn't know they moved it either. Okay, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Winston in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Winston.
Hi. In the summer of 75, I was visiting Detroit, and we had occasion to see the Fitzgerald. We were in Angel Park playing a softball game because the field is on the channel there on Lake Sinclair. And we interrupted our softball game because she was so large and loud, And we ran to the water's edge and watched her pass through. And one of the fellas asked, what's her name? And I saw on the prow, Edmund something or other, I said, because I didn't get the last name. And when she passed through, we were able to read on the fantail Edmund Fitzgerald, and we were all commenting on how large and magnificent this vessel was as she hove out of sight, and then we resumed our softball game. And then come to find out in November, she went down.
Winston, was it? Do you remember the sound? Was it noisy? I mean, I'm sure it wasn't.
Oh, it was loud. So loud we couldn't talk to each other. You know, we couldn't hold a conversation. You know?
Wow, interesting.
Thank you, Winston, for calling. Appreciate your call. You know, what were weather observations like at that time? You know, you wonder how much of a warning the ship had and so forth, or any ships.
Yeah, you know, in 1975, the National Weather Service the forecast for the storm was pretty good, considering the time. And, I mean, if you think back 45 years, the era of satellite observations was really just beginning. Numerical weather prediction was really just starting to take off. So we've, in this 45 years, have really improved our forecasting. Back then, they were also doing a relatively good job of the forecast. It's just the primary issue, I think, is that the storm really intensified faster than the National Weather Service was predicting at the time. And so throughout, you know, November 9th and November 10th, the National Weather Service would issue updates. And pretty much each update was that the storm was now more intense and shifting in terms of where the winds would be coming from.
Hmm. Well, let's go to Jeff and Kiwani next. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. I was on a ferry going from Key West to Naples, Florida one day, 25 years ago with my two young kids, and we took a tour of the bridge of the ferry. It was late at night. And I asked the wheelman, where were we? We're 50 miles out. I said, how deep's the water? He said, 50 feet. I said, wow, that's going to tear up pretty good. And a guy next to me, there was one other guy on the bridge, and he said, and I said, I'm from Green Bay, and the bay is really shallow, and it kicks up. Mm-hmm. He said, yeah, I've been in there before. I was on the Anderson the night that the Fitzgerald went down. And he said, I was at the wheel, and there were 60-foot waves crashing on the wheelhouse. And we heard that they went down, and they asked us to turn around, and they said no. So,
yeah, but, you know, that's really interesting. I know that in interviews with the captain of the Anderson, when the Coast Guard – once the Anderson realized that they were probably down, that the Fitzgerald was probably down because they couldn't see it and they couldn't get it on their radars, they were trying to get the Coast Guard to go out and get it. But the Coast Guard said it was too rough to, you know, launch a ship. And they asked the Anderson to turn around and go look for them. And the Anderson did turn around and go look for them at the risk and peril of all the sailors on there, because in the interview that I had read, you know, one of the sailors was just like, well, if that was us, we would want somebody to turn around. So, yeah, it was risky, and they did. And so it was the Anderson, and there was another ship that was out on the lake at the time. I don't remember the name of that one, that also went and tried to find survivors.
Yeah, and at great risk, for sure. Jeff, thank you. Appreciate it very much. Dale in Two Harbors, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Dale.
Hello. This is a great show you're having.
Thank you.
I just wanted to call in because I've had a lot of different kind of connections, I guess, with the lake and the whole Fitzgerald thing. Read some books on it. My father used to work at a shipyard in Superior, Wisconsin, Fraser Shipyard. And he used to work on a lot of those boats. And I remember he used to take, when I was young, he'd take me down to the pier there and talk about the Mighty Fitz and all the boats. And when the ship actually did sink, I remember getting up, and I was in junior high. And it was a really stormy day, of course, very, very stormy. And he said that a ship had gone down the night before on the lake. And then it was, he told me it was Fitzgerald and everything like that.
Well, woke you up in the in the night to tell you, Dale. Thank you for calling. Frank in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi.
Yes, hello. Thank you. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. I wanted to call in and say that my wife's father had been first mate on Edmund Fitzgerald 2 years before it went down. And he went on to get his captain's license, and he was captaining a ship that weathered the storm in Ashland at the time. And he knew all the men that went down on the Fitz. He'd worked with them all. And he was quite adamant that he said those hatches would have been tightened down. He said no captain left harbor without making those hatches secure. So I'm just speculating that was maybe a mechanical failure that happened there. It wasn't neglect by any of the crew members, I'm sure. And her father spent his life on the Great Lakes, and when he finished, he was captain of a number of different boats before he retired. And in all respect, I mean, he knew everybody out there, and he knew all those men. And he did say when he died, he said, I want to be cremated. But he said, please don't spread my ashes in that lake. He said, I've spent my whole life trying to stay out of it.
Wow. Interesting. Frank, thank you so much for giving us that story. My goodness.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
Ken from Central Wisconsin said when he was stationed in Europe, his roommate was a former sailor on the boat. His roommate said it was common practice that only 50% of the hatches were used because it was faster. He believed it was a combination of hatch locks and something, a rogue wave that sunk the boat. And the weather conditions that caused the storm, somebody asked about that as well, Steve.
Yeah. I mean, as John Knox, my co-author, and I often say, you know, what sunk the ship? The weather. It was this weather that sunk the ship. If it would have been a nice day, nothing would have went down. And so, yeah, it was a mid-latitude cyclone. You know, it's not uncommon to get really strong storms like this. Although it's not all that frequent. We had one in 1940. The Armistice Day storm was pretty much the same type of storm. And that, you know, killed a bunch of people, not only on the lakes, but also duck hunters.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's so beautiful, and then it changes so rapidly. And then in 1998, again, it was almost the exact same storm. And during that storm, no one died because weather forecasting had gotten so much better that, you know, the warnings got out on time and were more accurate.
Yeah. Well, this has been a lot of fun, Steve. I know you're going to stay with us, but thanks for talking with us today about the Edmund Fitzgerald. And we'll look forward to what you have to say with John Martin about weather and climate. Thanks. Thanks,
all right,
Steve.
Yeah, thank you.
Hang in there. Steve Ackerman, our guest today. Great to have him with us. And he's going to stay with us because our other weather guy, John Martin's joining to talk weather and climate. That next on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald. And the legend lives on from the Chippewa on down of the big lake they call Gitche-Gumee. Superior, they said, never gives up her dead when the gales of November come early.